This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome from David Rutledge. We are in the Philosopher's Zone. Welcome to the show and the second in a two-part series on obscurity and intellectual difficulty in the academic humanities. So you know how the business of getting published in an academic journal generally works. You write something, you submit it to the journal, your writing usually but not always undergoes a process of peer review, and then finally, if the paper is accepted by the journal, it gets published and sent out into the world. But what if the paper that you've written and submitted to the journal is a parody, a deliberately nonsensical piece of writing that's designed to embarrass the editors of the journal if they go ahead and publish it? We've seen this happen at least twice in recent academic history, most famously in 1996 when the physicist Alan Sokal had a hoax paper published in the journal Social Text, and more recently in 2018 when a team of three scholars revealed that they too had succeeded in getting a series of hoax papers published across a range of humanities journals. In each case, the target of the hoaxes was an academic community that had supposedly lost its scholarly bearings and given itself over to shallow intellectual fashion. Alan Sokal in 1996 was setting out to demonstrate that the discipline of cultural studies would accept any old nonsense as legitimate scholarship as long as that nonsense flattered the ideological preconceptions of the scholars involved. And the 2018 crew wanted to show that the humanities had fallen victim to identity politics and postmodern obscurantism. Well, today we're talking about these hoaxes and what they tell us and what they don't tell us about knowledge production, about what the academic humanities, which include philosophy, are supposed to be doing and how they're supposed to be doing it. Joe Hughes is a senior lecturer in English and Theatre Studies at the University of Melbourne, and Elliot Patsura is a postdoctoral research fellow also at the University of Melbourne, where he's a co-convener of the Critical Research Association Melbourne Network. So I'd like to begin with this issue of difficulty in the academic humanities, because disciplines like philosophy and sociology and cultural studies are often criticised for being hopelessly obscure to the average layperson, and yet that's not a criticism that we generally find levelled at the sciences, like nobody's telling astrophysicists that their work should be free from jargon or technical language. So if we can begin with you, Joe, what is it about the humanities that elicits this demand for clarity and accessibility? And I won't ask you yet whether or not you agree with the demand, but what justifies the demand to the people who make it?
I do think that there is a legitimate expectation that the discourse of the humanities should be accessible in a way that perhaps other fields are not. I mean, this is a philosophy podcast, so maybe we could start there. You know, at some level, the questions that philosophy reflects on around the nature of the beautiful, the good, the true, about what constitutes a legitimate form of argument and so on, they're not abstract questions at all, not only because a rigorous determination of the true, for instance, would probably apply to everybody, but because at every turn of everyday life, I think, people are making decisions about what constitutes the good and searching, like however briefly, for criteria for those decisions. Or they're arguing about what ends should govern the constitution of the state. Or they're thinking about what makes a good argument or how best to persuade somebody else of something and so on. And I don't think that most people have the time to pause to undertake some kind of meta-reflection on the nature of the criteria of the good, for example. But I do think they have a legitimate expectation of a discourse that does that, that it become legible. And it's worth saying, too, probably, that from Plato to Kant to Marx, most philosophers held some version of that thesis, that true ideas are universal, for example, and can be remembered by anybody, no matter their education or social status, or that metaphysics as such, you know, Kant argued, is grounded in an interest of reason, a kind of drive to ask fundamental questions that's universally shared and can't really be stopped. But at the same time, and for the very same reasons, I think the assumption that a reflection on fundamental problems or questions would remain at the level of everyday discourse is totally incoherent. Like, the very premise of entering into a discourse like philosophy is that the questions you're asking aren't immediately clear and that they don't have immediate responses. And it kind of requires drawing distinctions, naming the different steps in your process, creating new concepts, finding an appropriate method, developing that method, and so on. And to make things worse, philosophy has a very specific relation to its own history, one that's quite different from that of the arts or the sciences and so on. And all this means is that I think there's no way to do it well without entering into the discipline with discipline. You know, another way to think of it is that the question that we're asking right now is really quite 90s in the sense that it's, you know, kind of like beckons back to the period when Judith Butler was winning awards for her allegedly bad style, and Jacques Derrida, as just said last week on the podcast, was labeled a terrorist obscurantist. But I suppose my position is just that at some level, that shift in discourse is a necessary consequence, it's something that's structurally unavoidable once you start asking in a serious way certain kinds of questions.
So you're saying then that, as the argument goes, it's that the whole point of the humanities is to reveal things to us about our own lives and our societies and ourselves. And so that being the case, we should be able to understand those revelations because they pertain directly to us. And yet, at the same time, where science is looking for clarity and laws and fixed determinations of objective truth, the humanities are interested in social and cultural and political phenomena that don't lend themselves to clarity. Is that the sort of tension you seem to be sort of gesturing in the direction of a sort of tension there?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, that's a lovely way that you just put it there. And I think some version of that is absolutely the case. And you know, another formulation of the position that I was just articulating would be to say that one way of thinking about the humanities generally, though it's dangerous to do these kinds of things, is precisely as you put it, to say it's a practice of determining the sense and orienting oneself in the process of life that it's as it's lived. And so to step back and to give a reflection on the concepts and values that structure our day-to-day existence can become an extremely useful thing. But that stepping back is very different from living through those concepts and values in day-to-day life, and that the difficulty comes in that gap defined by the stepping back from everyday life and determining the sense and concepts and values of what we're working through and living through.
Right. But do you agree that specialist language is a problem and that there's too much obscurity, too much jargon in certain areas of the humanities these days? Because that's a charge that we hear all the time.
Look, I think so. And I understand that some would find the very existence of this pretty concerning, and insofar as it doesn't quite match up to the ideal one might have of scholarship as a sort of earnest, perhaps even harmless or even isolated exercise. But we often forget that willful obscurity can serve a very specific pedagogical function, for example. You can take the case of the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, who's perhaps the most notoriously obscurantist writer and speaker. Perhaps not quite a terrorist, but grouped under the banner of French theory. Lacan is very explicit about getting his audience to labour with, to work over, the imprecision that's present in all language use. His deliberate obscurantism is designed to compel a certain patience with language that can help us to develop a greater sensitivity to how meanings are actually produced. So what he wants us to avoid in this sense is the easy reduction of what we read or hear to what we already think we know. So there's something to be said here about slowing down, about philosophizing or theorizing as a necessarily slow process, perhaps even a laborious process. And there's also something to be said, I think, about not spoon-feeding or infantilizing your audience, even if they might just enjoy that or even if that's what they're explicitly calling for. So instead, I think many working in the humanities are interested in thought as an adventure or even a challenge, perhaps even a sort of deeply felt attack on your surface understandings, on your everyday ways, but also everyday speeds of being and thinking. And I think that this attack, for lack of a better term, can and should be conducted both at the level of style as much as at the level of content. And the fixation that we come across these days, especially online, when it comes to instances of willful obscurity in the humanities, where we see entire disciplines that are dismissed out of hand as mere pretentiousness, for example, as deploying a particular language as cover for a lack of actual thought. In these online cases, what consistently seems to creep in at this point is a sort of conspiracy mindset. The general idea I find to be at play in so many of these dismissals is not only that ideological groupthink is at play throughout the humanities, but that this ideological groupthink is the direct product of some sort of intentional, wide-ranging scheme to capture young and vulnerable minds and then turn them towards some sort of egregious political project. And I think, again, we might slow down at this point and remind ourselves that not all thinking can be conveyed or must necessarily take the form of determinate propositional phrases. Rather, some thinking, especially thinking at the limit, should it not be reducible to what we already agree or think that we already know, needs to be provoked or compelled or evoked or even demonstrated or performed indirectly. And I think this is a big part of what the humanities can do. And I think what can hinder our appreciation of this is this fixation on particularly egregious cases of willful obscurity or pretentiousness in the humanities, and extrapolating from this that there is some sort of widespread oppressive regime on the horizon, when we might instead attribute these sorts of phenomena to things like bureaucratic or managerial failings, to things like imposter syndrome, to, you know, widespread calls to publish or perish in the humanities, to the immense, incredibly unsustainable time pressures that scholars are increasingly facing.
Yeah, and of course there is one, I mean, as you say that, I'm reminded that there is one area of the humanities where obscurity or obscurantism is maybe not encouraged, but certainly not sort of howled down in the way that it is in other areas of the humanities. And I'm thinking of literature. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if, you know, someone like Lacan, who you mentioned, who is just, yes, famously obscure, if what he's doing there is dealing with concepts that are, well, you could say too radical to be housed in everyday vocabulary, or that sort of self-consciously are inimical to everyday vocabulary. That's kind of the point. And that in those cases, we need to come up with new vocabularies, new modes of expression. And this is where the activities of the philosopher and the poet start to overlap. Might be drawing a longbow to call Lacan a poet. But I mean, do you think that's a legitimate fusion, or should literature and the social sciences kind of stay in their lanes? I'm reminded that Plato wanted to kick all the poets out of the Republic.
The figure that comes to mind here for me is, I'm reminded of the, moving back a few centuries, but the proto-romantic German philosopher Johann Herder, who takes issue in the late 18th century with the purportedly clear, formulaic, systematic language that's deployed by philosophers in the German Enlightenment and Western rationalism more broadly. He takes issue with what he terms the word fog of writers like his teacher Kant, to take one example. For Herder, this language, it obscures the messy and often embarrassing natural and historical and bodily elements that Herder thinks lie repressed at the base of traditional philosophical constructions. So he calls for what we might describe it as a poetic turn in philosophical expression, that is, a turn away from formulaic and systematic language and towards the personal, the bodily, and the historical aspects of our being. So what he's highlighting is that style isn't a mere overlay or a mere means of transmitting an already fully formed, premeditated thought. Instead, the language of philosophy must in some way mirror the dynamism, perhaps even the imprecision and the indeterminacy of its object, should it stand any chance of accurately or truthfully conveying that object. So again, I think it's important to be really clear when one is leveling this charge of obscurantism, or is trying to problematize the, you know, poetification of philosophy, I think it's really, really important to be as clear as you can about what exactly it is that is purportedly being obscured in these instances. And I think this is important because these instances often reveal a surprising set of dogmatic, uncritical, or as Herder suggests, even quite embarrassing foundational commitments or even pathological fixations on the part of the person taking issue with obscure philosophical language.
You're listening to The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge. I'm joined this week by Joe Hughes and Elliot Patsura from the University of Melbourne. We're talking about the issue of obscurity in humanities disciplines like philosophy and sociology and cultural studies. And this is the second in a two-part series. You can catch part one on The Philosopher's Zone website or via ABC Listen. The two of you have been doing research on academic scandals, which is such an interesting area to be exploring. And by scandals, we're talking about occasions where a certain kind of spotlight is thrown onto the humanities. The emperor is supposedly shown to be wearing no clothes. The kind of thing where someone sends a paper to a trendy academic journal and the paper gets published, but then it turns out to be a hoax, like the paper's deliberately full of nonsense. So before we get to talking about a couple of these specific incidents, What is it about them that leads you to call them scandals? Because that's a term that you're using very deliberately. What exactly do you mean when you call something a scandal?
It's probably worth just reflecting on the nature of a scandal in the first place before we dive in, because a lot of the hoaxes that we may or may not talk about end up generating conversations that have the structure of conspiracy theories, in the sense that you know this, if you or somebody you love is bound up in the world of conspiracy theory, that you immediately become embroiled in a kind of contestatory and antagonistic discourse about whether X or Y is the case. And you lose sight of the fact that the very terms of the question are extraordinarily dubious and questionable. And with a lot of these hoaxes, it becomes very easy to start worrying about the nature of knowledge production in the humanities, for example, or whether your own work is rigorous enough, and so on. And you can quickly forget that all of the hoaxes, or most of them, are essentially fraudulent, that they're bad faith and politically motivated stunts, and that they attack ideals about peer review or the nature of knowledge that, in fact, nobody would actually hold on reflection. And so the risk of a conversation like this is that we would get caught up in the claims of the hoaxers themselves, like, are postmodernists reality-denying lunatics responsible for fake news, or are woke cultural Marxists corrupting the youth? It's like, that's not the question, and that's not why scandals are interesting. You know, I was thinking, a scandal is something quite different from an ordinary transgression, or it's a transgression of a specific kind, a certain kind of wrong, where the wrong in question differs from, example, theft or arson, or like this whole scale of wrongs in which one person harms another. Those only become scandalous when it's like a fireman starting a fire or something like that, which is to say, when something in the social order reveals itself to be working in a way other than we had assumed, like the fireman should be putting out fires, not starting them, and suddenly this social function turns on itself, right? And so a scandal implies something like a stumbling block in the social order itself, when suddenly its norms and the collective fantasies that structure social interaction find themselves in a kind of conflict, or at least in question. And I think if there's something valuable in thinking about these journalistic scandals, it's less for the claims that the hoaxers themselves make than for the way they can make visible different ideals around scholarship and what scholarship does, sets out to do, and the different varieties of its discursive formations.
Okay, so that's a really nice way of leading us into this. So the most famous of these scandals then has been the so-called SoCal affair, or the SoCal hoax, which took place nearly three decades ago, but it still gets talked about. In fact, I believe there's a new book on the SoCal affair currently in the pipeline. So just to fill anyone listening in who might not have heard of it, just very, very broadly, what happened there?
So the story goes that Orrin Sokal, who is at the time a professor of physics at New York University, and a self-described academic leftist with no quarrels with science. He comes across a book that's published in 1994 that's titled Higher Superstition, the Academic Left and Its Quarrels with Science. Sokal comes to agree with the book's core proposition that reflections on theoretical physics made by prominent post-structural theorists like Derrida are, in Sokal's terms, not only, quote, off the wall, end quote, that is completely nonsensical, but that they are, in fact, contributing to and are a symptom of a sad state of affairs in the academy, specifically whereby a large, diverse, and influential segment of the American academic community in particular is thought to be unambiguously hostile in their tone towards science. Sokal then writes and submits an article titled Transgressing the Boundaries Towards the Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity, to the Cultural Studies Journal Social Text. His article mimics, rather than critiques, this what he sees to be this unambiguously hostile tone, and it rehashes what he takes to be, you know, the sort of greatest hits of this segment of the American academic community. So what happens? Sokal's submission is accepted by the journal, and the article is published in the summer issue of the journal in 1996. Now, this adventure in ideas suddenly gets recoded as parody 3 weeks after it's published in Social Text. Sokal reveals in another journal, in a piece he titles A Physicist Experiments with Cultural Studies, that he, quote, intentionally wrote the article so that any competent physicist or mathematician or undergraduate physics or math major would realize that it is a spoof.
Yeah, well, look, and I want to sort of keep that plate spinning for a sec, because we will get on to what we take from this scandal, this hoax. But before we get there, I just want to quickly go over another, a sort of a much bigger, more ambitious replay of the SoCal hoax that happened in 2017, 2018, when we saw three authors, Peter Boghossian, James Lindsay and Helen Pluckrose, got together and carpet bombed a range of journals with a range of hoax papers. What happened there, just briefly?
I think your description of it as a carpet bombing is a good one, in the sense that keeping that military metaphor alive, you know, it was essentially an act of aggression. And if you look at the apparatus around the hoax, the documentary that they produced, lectures that they've given online and so on, it's really clear that the aim is to burn the university down, as they say in one lecture, to take the whole edifice down. I think that's where it differs. It's one of the ways in which it differs fundamentally from the SoCal hoax. Both are politically motivated. Both draw on false ideals around the production of knowledge in the academy. Both like to reduce it to one function. Both of them have absolutely unrealistic views of what peer review can meaningfully accomplish. And all of that, they're similar. But this one mobilizes an extreme political ideology. It draws on funding that remains hazy. It wants to take the whole of academic discourse and subject it to a media trial, where the media is only the media that they themselves directly govern or like-minded individuals govern. So I think with this second hoax, we're in a brand new territory, an eminently contemporary territory based on the weaponization of knowledge in a sequence of more diffuse ideological wars.
The politics is really interesting because we do see in the years following James Lindsay in particular disappearing down a very alarming rabbit hole, but we don't need to follow him down that now. But
no, no.
what do you think we learn from these affairs, though? I mean, what is it about that interests you in terms of, as you say, what the production of knowledge is supposed to be, the nature of academic discourse and how it's all supposed to work?
For me, there's a sense in both affairs that the hoaxes are somewhat uncomfortable with indeterminate language or with forms of expression that, again, demand to be laboured over, read and pondered slowly, with no guarantee that you might actually get anything out of it. They also appear quite uncomfortable granting a level of charity to scholars that are attempting to forge an intellectual community that encourages these particular sorts of reading and communication practices. Also, despite the hoaxes consistently drawing attention to their leftist credentials, their terms, not mine, both affairs strike me as in fact quite conservative. By this I mean that they often boil down to a sort of retrospective fantasy and a demand to return to a prior, more ideal moment in history. So specifically, the moment that preceded the arrival of French theory on American shores in the 1960s, and they want to return to this moment through the sheer force of tools like parody or, you know, owning their opponents, but also, I think, pearl-clutching and sort of distributing scary moral warnings. So I think this is all quite unfortunate because in the institutionally, you know, marginal disciplines that are targeted by both hoaxes, the level of charity and the duty of care that's often extended by scholars involved can, I think, really contribute to an entirely different model of intellectual community from that with which we're familiar with in the academy today. So, you know, given the highly unforgiving, structurally inequitable, increasingly and unsustainably competitive, you know, dog-eat-dog world of academia that we're currently faced with, what might be described as perhaps, you know, historically speaking, less stringent editorial and peer review practices that are not only open to non-standard approaches, but that are aware of the structural challenges that so many budding academics especially face. I think all that certainly has its place.
I couldn't agree more, Elliot. And you know, as we've been talking, one of the things that I've been thinking about is the fact that if you were to take the challenge of the hoaxes on their own terms, the kind of reaction that you would have or that they'd envisage you having is something like, oh, my scholarship is—it's not rigorous enough. I need to push harder to get to these scientific standards, or something like that. But in fact, I think an inversion of that point of view is what comes out in the end for me, and it's a kind of realization that what the hoaxes would probably like to do is to rigorously restrict the style of academic discourse. They'd like to rigorously limit the kinds of knowledge that count as knowledge, and they'd like one single kind of discourse to stand out. And what's really striking when you look at all of the different discourses that they target, from queer theory to trans studies to Black studies and so on, is the radical heterogeneity of discursive practices and epistemic practices that are at play there. And I think that variety itself is in fact awe-inspiring and is extraordinarily important. And the fact that we have multiple different modes of engaging in an intellectual way with our world is exactly the strength of these disciplines. And, you know, I was clicking around on some website and I found a Google folder that where they've uploaded all of the documents for this, the second hoax. And in there is the folder of all of the peer reviews that they received for some of the articles that were accepted and most that were rejected. And when you read through those, it's really kind of astonishing the extent of the charity of the reviewers and of the care that they took with these articles and of the intelligence and the insight that they bring to them. It, you know, reading through those letters, I was in awe of the generosity of a lot of the interlocutors. And so I think, you know, the thing that I take from the hoax is probably the inverse of what they'd like us to take. It's a kind of robust and vital discursive field defined by its differences and the heterogeneity of practices, all bound up with a sense of seriousness and care toward their object of study that I find just utterly astonishing.
Yeah, you make a good point there, I think, about intellectual generosity. And I think it's worth noting the bad faith and the lack of generosity on the part of the people who perpetrate these hoaxes. But all that aside, do you think that the hoaxes have a point insofar as there are arguably some areas of the humanities where rigorous intellectual standards take second place to tribal solidarity or ideological orthodoxy? I mean, I'm not going to ask you to name names or mention specific disciplines, but is there a problem in some corners of the humanities?
No. I mean, are there disciplines we don't like, Elliot? we'd like to name here because this is our chance. You know, at some level, I would hope that there were corners where something like that happened. I also suspect that this accusation is more of a kind of projective self-description on the part, especially of the blip hoax, the second one, which I think really does stem from a kind of tribal orthodoxy that the very jargon of their explanatory apparatus consistently signals. But I do think that there are very intense clusters of intellectual activity in the humanities broadly. And I also suppose I would expect there to be and hope that there would be, in the sense that humanities research is not only about the true, but also about the good and the beautiful. And I would hope that people who held strong positions about those things held them strongly, communally, and with a commitment. And so I think a certain kind of tribalism is important. Awake, but not woke, I suppose would be the motto. Not a blind tribalism, but a committed tribalism. Tribalism isn't a good word here, and I don't like repeating it, but you know what I mean.
The only thing I sort of wanted to add there, David, was that the hoaxes are, to some degree, useful, hence why we're studying them, horrific as they are, insofar as they highlight problems that are worth thinking about, worth addressing, but that are not limited solely to the humanities. So you might think, for example, of, you know, the increasing attention that's now being paid, not only across academia, but again across the mainstream media, to something like, you know, the falsification of data in you know, so-called hard disciplines like, say, psychology and economics. We're facing a, you know, replication crisis, for instance, whereby the result of something like 40% of published papers in some of these disciplines are purportedly, cannot purportedly be replicated. That's obviously quite a problem if the whole appeal of the scientific method is that replicability is indexed to objectivity. What this also forces us to ask, I think, is why is all this happening? The hoaxes, but also the sort of replication crises that we're facing. Is it because the opportunities merely exist to exploit something like the system of peer review? To that, I would reply, you know, are these opportunities, you know, really that new? But I think we could also consider what might compel someone to perform these sorts of acts, be it a hoax, be it the falsification of data. In the latter case, a structural account, I think, of you know, the dire state of the neoliberal university, where one must again publish or perish, I think something like that might suggest that institutional conditions drive people towards these sorts of actions, and I think that that's worth keeping in mind.
Elliot Patsura, he's a postdoctoral research fellow and co-convener of the Critical Research Association Melbourne Network at the University of Melbourne, and he was joined there by Joe Hughes, who's senior lecturer in English and Theatre Studies, also at the University of Melbourne. And as I mentioned earlier, this has been the second in a two-part series on obscurity in the academy. You can find part one on the Philosopher's Zone website or via ABC Listen. And I'm David Rutledge. Thanks so much for your company this week, and I hope you can join me next time. Bye for now.